folks. Good morning or afternoon, depending on where you are. This is Dan Kahn. I'm the National Field Director for the Peace Alliance, and welcome to our September monthly call. We still have a few minutes before the top of the hour, so I want to give people a chance to introduce themselves and maybe tell us where you are. So I'll just call you out by name. I can see you on the dashboard here. And if you would just say hello and let us know where you are, and if there's other folks with you, let us know that too. So I'll start off with Phineas Washer. Finn in Houston, you want to say hello?
Yes, this is Finn Washer, and I'm calling from Houston, Texas. There is no one with me.
So great to have you with us, Finn. Good morning.
Good morning, Dan. Nice to hear your voice.
Yes, you too. Welcome. And I see Geraldine Stapleton. Geraldine, you want to say hello for us?
Hi, everybody. I'm here in Hollywood, California, calling from my house. I'm by myself. Anyway, it's great to
so great to hear your voice, Geraldine.
Yeah. I'm sorry I missed you when you were in the area. I wish I had a better a car that was in better condition to be making a long trip.
Well, maybe we'll work that out next time. I look forward to seeing you. Look forward to seeing you in Washington.
Yes, me too. I'm really getting excited about the conference. Yeah, we haven't had one for so long, and so this is really wonderful that we're doing this. I'm really looking forward to it.
Absolutely. We are too. We are too. All right. And I also see Cheryl in Gainesville. Cheryl, want to say hello?
Hi, everybody. I'm Cheryl from Gainesville, Florida. And I'm going to the conference, too, so I get to meet a lot of you for the first time, even though we've been talking on the phone. It'll be nice to put faces to names.
Absolutely. It's going to be so great to have you here and the rest of you. Well, we're at the top of the hour, so I see there are a lot of other folks that have joined us. I see Josh in Oakland and Ann in Michigan and Nancy in North Carolina and Bobby Joe in Inland Empire and Peggy in Ohio and other folks. But we're at the top of the hour, so I want to just welcome you all again to our September monthly action call for the Peace Alliance. So great to have you here with us. We have a lot of stuff on our agenda, as usual, and in a moment, I'm going to be introducing our special guest, David Bornstein. First, I want to take just a minute to mention this is sort of a kind of an intense time, as many of you may be experiencing just in the history of our country and the national climate right now, or right around September 11th. People's hearts may be a little bit heavy this week, dwelling on remembrances and the repercussions of what happened on September 11th. And I just want to say that I'm honored to be among you folks and folks like you who continue to find motivation and inspiration to move forward with our visions and our plans and our intentions and actions to create greater and greater human capacities to make and sustain peace in every facet of this world. So I'm really grateful for everything that you do. And I'm grateful to be among you. So before I introduce David, I want to give him a quick introduction to who you are. Welcome, David. You're going to be speaking today with folks in our nationwide volunteer network, and many of these folks are also members of our Peace Alliance action teams. And these are people who look at the news about violence and war and incarceration of children, and they decide that there's power in their actions to make a positive difference in the world. These are people like Peggy Hanna and her team in Clark County, Ohio, who've gotten multiple op-eds, letters, and one feature article published in their local paper within the past year, all in support of practical peace-building programs and policies, specifically the Youth Promise Act. And they didn't stop there. They have obtained endorsements of that bill from their city commission, county sheriff's office, and a regional mental health council. And they didn't stop there. They brought all those endorsements and all that earned media to the attention of their two U.S. senators and their U.S. House member, who happens to be Speaker John Boehner. And they are gradually educating Speaker Boehner and his staff about the life-saving and cost-saving programs that can significantly reduce youth incarceration and violence and can be expanded through passage of the Youth Promise Act. And now Peggy and her team have an in-person meeting scheduled with Speaker Boehner's Chief of Staff, during our upcoming national conference, which begins October 16th. So they'll have an even deeper meeting of the minds on this powerful subject. So these are the kind of folks that you'll be talking with today. And now let me tell them a little bit about you. David Bornstein is a co-founder of the Solutions Journalism Network, whose mission is to support rigorous and compelling reporting about responses to our social problems. David's writing has appeared in the New York Times, the Atlantic Monthly, the European Business Journal, and many other publications. He's the author of several books, including How to Change the World, The Price of a Dream, and Social Entrepreneurship, What Everyone Needs to Know. David is someone whose words I've quoted, or at least paraphrased, to our action teams and the rest of our network more than once when I've encouraged you to share your stories through the media, emphasizing more light and less tunnel. We are thrilled and deeply grateful to have you here with us today, and a very warm welcome to you, David.
Well, thank you, Dan. Well, thanks. It's a pleasure to be with all of you. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, Hello? We hear you fine. Thanks.
Okay,
yes.
Good. Yeah. I guess the thing that I want to share with you, which is the particular vantage point that I have. I've been writing a column called Fixes at the New York Times for the past 5 years. It's a weekly column that looks at innovative solutions to social problems. So we're talking about more than 300 columns, and really reporting on this field, what some people call social innovation or social entrepreneurship or whatever, for more than 20 years. And the thing that's most important to remember is that the view of the world that we get from the news, from the media, is extremely distorted. I mean, if you can imagine a picture of a landscape where somebody has airbrushed out 90% of the trees and you have a denuded landscape, then people say this is reality. You would look at that and you say, that's not reality. That's a distorted image that makes it look much uglier than it really is. Well, that's really how the world works. I mean, that's really how media works, particularly in journalism. And unfortunately, the effect of it, the idea behind journalism is that you're supposed to try to sort of get people aware or even outraged so that the forces, the powers that be, will, including the citizens or the institutions, will solve the problems. The problem with journalism's sort of theory of change is that it misses a really big part of human behavior, which is that we end up often feeling helpless or having a very impoverished sense of the actual possibilities when you don't present people with those possibilities on a regular basis. So sort of the crucial work that we've been doing with Solutions Journalism is to integrate into the normal course of journalism, into the DNA of journalism or the water supply of journalism, the idea that we should be, when we report on problems, we should be looking intentionally and very energetically for the responses that are emerging to those problems all around the world or all around the city or society or whatever your frame is. So that's what we've been doing. And the interesting thing is, when you begin practicing journalism that way, you sort of realize we live in an extraordinarily adaptive society in the United States, and also in many, many parts of the world that we think of as just terrible places. It's astonishing to when you actually begin reporting on how people are responding and adapting to problems, you begin to seeing the world in a completely different light, and you realize that the feelings of hopelessness, I mean, you mentioned September 11th. It's very interesting when you think of September 11th, when you think of all the coverage that's been given to terrorism, you know, over the past 15 years, if you compare around the world the number of sort of social entrepreneurs that they are and the number of people whose lives they're impacting positively and the number of people in the world who are terrorists and the number of lives that they're impacting, it's not even close. The social entrepreneurs probably outnumber them by 100-1. You can't even compare them, actually, in terms of major structural forces in the world today. But if you speak to a bunch of journalists or ordinary watchers of CNN, they don't believe you. They think that, how can that be? I read about ISIS in the news every day. There's 10 million village lending groups, 10 million women in Africa who have joined village lending groups just in the past 8 or 9 years or so. I don't think I've seen one story about that. So the upshot is that there's an extraordinary range of adaptation and creative innovation to try to improve the world. It's happening all the time. It's in our communities. It's all around. And what we do when we go into news organizations, and we work with we've worked with about 50 major news organizations across the U.S., but we're really building a movement that we hope will be part of every news organization over the next decade. We show them, you know, we worked with the New York Times, the Seattle Times, the Detroit Free Press, the Boston Globe, NPR, the PBS NewsHour, I mean, you name it, you know, large network news as well. And what we do is we help them see that when you cover health, you know, there's all sorts of things that people are doing today to sort of reduce obesity, improve diabetes, things like that. In the area, you know, that you were talking about with violence, with youth violence, there's an extraordinary movement in the United States around what's called decarceration. This very, very powerful effort to change the way we've been dealing with the whole justice question, you know, over the last 30 years. It's a total catastrophe, as you all know. But the other side of the story, California has reduced its prison population by about 20% in recent years. So has New York State. So has New Jersey. There's many cities and states and counties that are actively trying to reduce the number of people, nonviolent offenders especially, who are behind bars. There's whole movements now to try to eradicate juvenile justice or juvenile detention or imprisonment. There's major movements across the United States in many schools to ban the suspension of young children because it tends to be 5 or 6 to 1 African-American kids who get suspended compared to white children for the same things. So what you see, and this is the kind of the good thing about working with a network of journalists, is you can kind of get a heat map for where the activity is around the country. So what we find now, so the question I think is maybe most relevant to you, since you work directly and try to influence editors, and I've written about results and I know results well, I know Sam Daly Harris well, and also the Citizens Climate Lobby, so I really understand the power of your work, and I think it's enormously leveraged and really important. The main thing that we're seeing now is we need to help citizens change journalism in its core mission, so that we help editors really realize that in order to cover society faithfully and actually to provide news that truly engages citizens, it's necessary to report rigorously, not in a hero worship way, but rigorously on the responses. And so we help news organizations. And our website, if you go to it, you'll see there's lots and lots of tools that we're developing for journalists and editors to be able to find solution stories. One of the things we would like to do, and this is something perhaps we could work on together, is we would like to develop tools to help citizens influence the coverage more broadly in the news organizations in their communities to adopt a more solutions-focused lens. And one of the ways that we do that, and probably the most powerful argument we have, is that when you do solutions journalism rigorously, the journalists feel proud about it. They end up realizing that it's very high-quality journalism. The citizens tend to be more engaged reading the news, and their hit rates go up on their websites. So it's very good for the publishers because they all want to make some money in this business. And the third thing is that the stories actually lead to social impact. They actually lead to policy changes, to citizens gathering around the solutions. It's sort of an amazing thing about people. When you present them with tools, when you put tools on the table and you say, you need to build something, here's some tools, people will go ahead and use those tools. And that's really the value of solutions journalism. It doesn't just tell people, we have a problem, you know, these people have been corrupt, or there's malfeasance here, or something like that. It says, we have a problem, but here's the available responses that are coming up in our community. Here's some responses coming up in other communities. Which ones make most sense for us to explore? The conversation becomes far less polarized. It's not a negative, backward-looking, you know, how did we get here and who's to blame conversation. It's a forward-looking, where should we prioritize, you know, what resources do we have, what are our next steps kind of conversations. It's extremely good for democracy. It actually brings people together. It even builds empathy. It's and we've seen this. We have studies to show this. We've done work with universities to try to show the effect, how journalism actually improves the public conversation and activates citizens so that they feel more powerful. So I would really, you know, we've mostly worked with journalism today. We've trained more than 1,000 journalists, but we're trying to branch out to really start working with the general public and ordinary citizens to sort of be part of this movement to really change the way journalism functions. And this gets right to the core of getting editorials written or getting feature articles written that really draw the attention of citizens and policymakers, researchers, students, whoever, business people, to the adaptive capacities and the best responses we have at any given point to our problems. So this is a growing field. We started this 2 years ago. We thought it would be really hard to get journalists to change their way. But there's a funny thing about a crisis. The news business is in crisis. And when people are in crisis, they're actually very receptive to change because they know that stasis means, in most cases, that they're going to end up going out of business if they don't change. So they're quite open to rethinking ideas, especially ideas that you can show them will more effectively engage their constituents, their readers, and don't require them to do anything that's fluffy or puffy or assaults their sensibility as serious writers. So that's kind of the art of it all. So if you present stories in that way, I think that you have a really good chance now, especially in this context, of really getting them taken up more and more, and not just from the editorial pages too, but from the reporters on various beats. So I guess that's just a kind of an overview of the solutions journalism work. There's a lot of stuff that we're developing. We have research materials, many, many examples. We have probably 1,000 examples of solutions journalism stories. We have courses we've developed for universities and presentations and things. It's really a growing movement. It's kind of exciting to see. I'll pause there.
Okay, great. That's really beautiful, David. I love that, and I think this is going to be a call that's going to, the recording of this call will be available on our website, and I have the feeling this is one that is going to be a great resource that folks will want to review. To remind folks, you're going to have a chance to ask questions and get involved in this discussion. If you want to ask a question, please press 1 on your keypad, and that'll show me a raised hand, and I'll be able to call on folks. So just press 1 and I'll see it. David, you mentioned that there are a lot of great resources on your website. Will you repeat that web address for us?
Sure. It's just solutionsjournalism.org.
Great. Solutionsjournalism.org. And this is so timely, I think, when so many of our folks have been writing letters, getting some of them published, writing op-eds, beginning to develop relationships with editors. This is a chance to get a little bit more detailed and specific about how those connections with those editors might actually develop. I see a few hands up, and welcome more folks, too. I'll go ahead and call on Ann in Michigan. Hold on a sec. Let me unmute you. Go ahead, Ann.
Well, thank you so much, Mr. Bernstein, for what you're doing. I read the Detroit Free Press frequently, and I'm often disturbed by what is reported. It's, you know, the saying, if it bleeds, it leads. You probably heard that. And that has taken on an incredible, I don't know how to word it exactly, but that's what I see a lot in the paper, and I don't even read the articles. So I look at the headlines and go on. And I would certainly like to see positive things reported that are happening in Southeast Michigan. Who are you working with at the Detroit Free Press?
So the project is just getting going. I think that I don't know if they've launched their first story in it yet. So I would urge you. The project that we're doing is a one-year project, and it's going to focus on the question, what works to reduce and to prevent violence? I don't think they've yet published their first story. Once I say they've been doing sort of the preparation for it. So probably the best thing to do is, first of all, look for this series, and when it will launch is, I'm sure that they'll have an editorial or they'll have some sort of thing to the readers indicating that they're launching this series looking at ways to address violence. And it's the first major solutions-oriented series that they've ever done, so it's not a, you wouldn't have seen it. And exactly, you're 100% right. The reason why they want to do this series is because they realize that they follow this very negative, if it bleeds, it leads journalism that people, everybody has the same reaction to. It's depressing. I mean, you know, you want to know what's going on in the world, but you don't only want to know the problems. You also want to know the opportunities and the wisdom that's growing. So when you see these stories begin to emerge in the fall, you know, the greatest thing that could happen to us and to the Deutsche Press and to Detroit itself is for the newspaper to get a lot of feedback that, hey, what a great story. Thank you for letting us know that there are these new models that are emerging to reduce violence and really to get people talking about them and to comment about them and to give feedback to the paper. This is the kind of thing that we want to see more of, because the more feedback that they get, the more they're going to invest in that and the momentum will grow. This is still an uphill battle in journalism because we're talking about an identity shift to some degree. Most journalists think that their job is to be like a smoke detector, to be a warning sign, and to be a watchdog. They don't think that their job is to be a spotter, a talent scout for innovation in a way, which is a different kind of role, a different way of drawing attention, highlighting different aspects of work in society. And yet, when they don't do that, of course, they end up overwhelming people with the negative. So pay attention to what they're doing as this series emerges. And then, you know, really if you and your colleagues could give them feedback about, especially appreciative feedback if you see things you like, that's what's going to let it grow.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Great. I love how you talk about adaptive themes and adaptive stories, that it seems like just focusing on how we can evolve, how we can make positive progress is such a great emphasis. I have a few more questions out there. I'll call on Nancy in Hendersonville, North Carolina.
Hi. Boy, are you timely in terms of listening to you today. This is a common theme that runs through my brain all the time with regards to news and television. And so I'm really, really optimistic and excited about what you have to offer, and we'll be trying to put this to practice very soon. It really helps us to reframe our language to think in the way of solutions, what can be done. Television, to me, has no content that is pretty much wiped out now that's worth watching. Plus, the news groups are doing exactly what you said. Whenever I bring this up, I'm told, well, this is what sells. So I think that your talk about feedback is important because it helps them understand that there is another way to look at this and that they could actually change gradually over time if they got good feedback. I've always been looking for a good news channel on television. I think it'd be exciting, but they say it won't sell. I think it'd be great. But a newspaper can do the same. So when I ask or point out that television, for one, and newspapers, but most people watch TV, is this a boat in terms of their potential for education? And that's what you're addressing, because they could take it, you know, on to that kind of discussion. So I am really excited, and I don't know. I guess my one question is, how would you even begin to address this with different television networks, which appear to be so powerful, so politically powerful, so much money involved? Where do you even begin with that, or do you just begin locally with a newspaper? That's it.
That's a good question. There's a couple of different questions buried in there. One of them that I want to address that's, I think, very important is you mentioned that good news doesn't sell. It's true. Good news doesn't sell. There's all sorts of research that shows that when you put out a good news story, it doesn't do as well. People say they want it, but then they don't actually click on it. What we're talking about with solutions journalism is something very different, and we have some studies that show that we get more traffic. But it's not about good news. It's about ideas. It's about models. It's about people responding creatively to challenges. So these stories, when somebody, I don't know if you followed the, you know, if you followed, you know, what's happening today in the field of school suspension. There's many, many schools that need to reduce their suspensions or stop them altogether because they're so destructive and they're so racialized. Well, teachers still have bad behavior that they have to deal with. I mean, it's not like that goes away.
Yep.
So when you start talking about how do you actually bring in an alternative form of discipline that that works for the students and works for the teachers and makes the school a safer and more positive place? Well, that's a how-to question. That's not good news. That's not a story of a hero. That's a story of an idea and a methodology. It's like a detective story.
Mm-hmm.
How would you actually solve that case? When you write the story that way, it becomes a really interesting, compelling narrative because it's driven by curiosity. You're trying to understand. It's like a scientific experiment. You're trying to understand how Sherlock Holmes is going to solve the case here. That's exactly what it is. And that's why these stories do better than normal stories, because they're not good news stories. They're not about the kindness of stranger or people or a banker going to Africa or any of these fluffy stories that CNN heroes do kind of things. They're real stories about people doing smart things, and they become intelligence. And in fact, as you said, we now have more than 100 universities that are interested in assigning solutions journalism to students as part of their curriculum, because this is sort of a first rough draft of history of how the world today is adapting and responding to its variety of challenges, everything from poverty to health to environmental things and so forth. So this is real-time capture of human ingenuity in progress as it's unfolding at the community level or different levels. That's a story that journalists will run with. That makes they're very comfortable, and you can share the studies. We have one A-B study. An A-B study is a scientific study where you compare things that are very similar. In our case, we compared a non-solution story with a solution story that were quite similar except for one had more content about a solution. And we looked at hard issues, child trauma, homelessness, deep poverty in India. And in each case, the story that included an element of a solution, a credible solution, stories played far better. They were more shared, you know, everything that you want. They were more read. People stayed with them. They felt more optimistic. They said that they were going to engage in that issue more. They're more likely to engage in the issue. They want to read more articles from this newspaper. Everything that you would want to have went up when you included an element of a solution. And that's not a good news story. That's a story that's giving you more information. And we live in a society where people pay a lot of money to go to college. They may go bankrupt even going to college. So why is the news business the only business that's not giving you information when everyone else is paying through the teeth to get it?
That's my question every day. One other piece of this, too, for me, is the violence in our society and the role that the news media plays in actually bringing more about. I've worked in mental health and psychiatry, and it is true that when people on the outside see the news and someone has just done a killing, their boundaries are so loose that they just, actually, I worked with people who thought they had killed Kennedy, for example, the day he was assassinated. They couldn't separate that. So they take all that into their delusional material, and off they go. And the rash of killings that we've had, I believe, is really related to the attention that one person gets, and it seeps into a person with very loose boundaries and very bad mental health. How can you help reporters and news media see that they can also take this and discover what are some of the ways that we can help the public understand mental health and in this way and change some of this response? We give it far too much negative attention, far too much, and we're feeding the violence.
What you're describing is exactly the kind of role that your network can play very well. If you look at, so the problems scream, but the solutions whisper. So why do the problems scream? When there's a shooting, it's calling for news attention. That's something that every editor says, we have to cover it. You know, the body's there and everyone hears about it. But if there are 10 communities in your state that have done something smart to reduce gun violence or have figured out a better way of dealing with a particular situation or have found ways of reducing the excessive use of force in the police department, like some police departments have done around the country, the journalists don't naturally have it in their reflexes to say, oh, I'm going to look for a second day or a third day story that looks at how can we reduce violence, how are some places actually having success against the same issue. That's not their reflex. That story has to now be presented to them by an outside source. So that's what we do. We come in. But you can do the same thing. It means doing a little bit of research and saying, okay, here we have a problem. For example, you're from North Carolina, right? I don't know if you're anywhere near Fayetteville.
No.
If that's near you. But we helped the Fayetteville Observer. They were going to do a big series on gun violence. And we said to them, you know, why don't you do a series that looks at how do you create safety rather than that violence exists in your community. It's a very dangerous community. And so they created a series, and they called it Seeking Safety. And they spent, for a year, they went to 13 different cities, and they looked at different ways that different cities had increased public safety. And they did it through safety zones, through better responses to blight, through better teen mentoring, through all sorts of methods. And this series called Seeking Safety, and I encourage you to go look at it as an example. It's just Google Seeking Safety and Fayetteville Observer, and you'll see all the stories that they did. Now, this is a selling point to the newspaper. Because they wrote these stories and they were so creative about the way they approached this, the stories just played so well. Everybody read them. Not only that, the mayor, the church leaders, police leaders, they all got together with business leaders and they created a council to discuss what are we going to do about these ideas, how do we help them spread in our community and take root in our community. So that was a very positive way of reframing that issue you're talking about. So those examples, you can use those examples when you're talking to editors and saying, here are some places that have done different things, and it's been very good journalism. They were nominated for an award. Everybody in the community raved about the series because it was so helpful, and it's leading to social impact. That's not something that you would get if you just did a series saying, boy, we have a lot of gun violence. So that's the way to convince people in TV and news. You just have to help them see that there are better possibilities available.
Brilliant. Thank you, David, and thanks, Nancy, for those wonderful questions that opened up that discussion. I think we have time for one, possibly two more questions. I'm going to go to Phineas Washer over in Houston. Go ahead, Finn.
Hey, I'm assuming that the way we communicate this to an editor is by a letter to the editors. Is that right?
Well, actually, I think you can do something bolder than that. There's a lot of editors today who are interested in hearing from their constituents. There's the big word in journalism today is called engagement. If you go to any big news organization, any big news conference of journalists, everyone's talking about this idea of engagement. How do we get more people engaged with our stories, which means interacting with us, using them? How do we create public events where the journalism is part of the conversation, the journalism actually helps people have a better conversation? There's a big need today to do that because journalists feel that it has been a one-way street of communication for too long, that they've been throwing information out into the community but not engaging. So one of the ways that you can try to influence an editor is to present a different way of covering an issue area, saying, here, you've been covering crime a lot, but there's this bill that's being tabled in Congress now, and there's lots of examples in our state of interesting initiatives around youth justice reform. Our community would really love to see some stories about possibilities and solutions that are emerging, and perhaps we could even work with the paper to organize a public event and a conversation and invite some of your editors and reporters to report on this, to talk about some of the things they've reported on. that's the kind of thing that many editors would jump at because they think, wow, this is, first you're giving them ideas. If you do a little research and you have a couple of things to recommend, I mean, you want to present ideas that are credible to the editors, but then talk about what are ways that we can engage more deeply with you as a source of information. Some editors won't pay attention to that, but a lot of them, if you do that persistently and if you present a really credible idea for a public conversation, a lot of them will be very excited by that because it's really in the zeitgeist in journalism now to be engaging more deeply and more regularly with your readership. They even describe the people, they call them the people formerly known as the audience, which meaning that they're now participants.
Hey, this is really a two-part question. I want to go back to the letter to the editors, and I appreciate what you just said. It's been very helpful. But in the action, the three-page action sheet that we got for today, there's a sentence that says, remember, your letter is your own. It can be as basic or as detailed as you wish. I think this is talking about letters to the editors. Now, I sent a letter to the New York Times, and the answer I got back is, well, we're sorry, we do not print letters that are longer than 250 words. I couldn't find anything on the editorial page before I wrote the letter, but afterwards they informed me, in effect, that my letter was too long. So what is your take on that? Can letters be as detailed as you want them to be and an editor still look with favor upon them?
Generally speaking, the letters that get published in the New York Times make one point and then support it with some evidence and are pretty brief. I mean, that's one of the things they really do, you know, they try to give space to a lot of different voices. But that's actually pretty good advice because, you know, typically all you can really get across in an op-ed, which is 750 words, let alone a letter, which is much shorter, is one idea. So I would say that it's probably a better strategy to just focus on the one thing you want to say and then support it with no more than three bits of evidence, you know, citations. And you can also put links in your editors since a lot of them will be published online too. But I would say that that's, at least for the New York Times, I can't speak for other publications because I don't follow that as well. You can also take the same thing and add comments. A lot of people read comments in articles. I would encourage, if you see something in the New York Times that relates to an issue that you want to write about, I would encourage you to very quickly write a short comment, probably two paragraphs, but to do it as soon as possible because then it's one of the first comments and they get read the most because they're usually at the top. But thousands and thousands of people read those comments. I mean, it's quite a good exposure, and you can also put links in your comments back to issues and ideas and so forth. And by the way, journalists who write the articles also read the comments too. So if you write in a helpful comment, like I get lots of comments in my articles, and the ones that are the most helpful are people saying things like, usually it's nice, it's something like, thanks so much for drawing attention to this issue. I see you're interested in youth social justice issues. There's another angle that you could come at this would be to look at the problem this way. And here's an organization or here's a bill that is very promising in this area with a link to something or other. You're then engaging me as a fellow person trying to build a better world, which makes us peers and makes us colleagues. And you're giving me some information that can help me do my next story better and perhaps include a resource that I'm not aware of in my next story. So the comments are a great opportunity, especially if they're short and you get in and you do them early. Usually the first day or two people read the comments, and then I typically will not read comments that are posted after the first, you know, 48 hours or so. But that's a very effective way to communicate with a lot of writers and also to build rapport with them. You know, even to come in and say, you know, even if you have nothing to add, but you just want to sort of note, you want to say, I appreciate your hard work in shedding light on this question. And you know, those are the kinds of things that over time you can get a reporter to know your name through the comments on his or her pieces. Very, very simple, underutilized method for developing rapport with writers.
Thank you.
Thank you, Finn, for those questions. I appreciate the enthusiasm for this subject. There are a lot of other hands raised, but I think we're just about at the end of our time with David, and I want to really thank him for joining us. Thank you, David. It's been so informative and empowering. I think that the idea that people can take these simple steps and build relationships in that real most basic of ways, just let's get to know these people, let them know what's on our minds, and that there are practical solutions available that we'd like to see them cover. So thank you so much for joining us today. I think it's been tremendously helpful, and I wish you the best in your work.
Well, thank you, Dan. And just to follow up, we are going to be relaunching our website in about a month, perhaps between a month and 2 months. And we want to put some tools on the website specifically for citizens to be able to encourage their local publications, news organizations, to do more reporting about solutions. So we would be very happy to engage, if any of you are interested in trying out some of these tools and actually seeing if it makes a difference when you engage with your local news organizations, please be in contact with us. And once we have those packages up on the website, we can talk about it and you could let us know your experiences and we can learn by doing and sort of iterate until we have a system that is working. Because I think that there's a lot of opportunity to influence news in much bigger ways than getting one or two articles here and there, really a more systematic shift in the way they cover their communities. That's the big opportunity now. So my email, you know, Dan has my email, so you guys can reach out to me if anyone in your network is interested in that approach.
That sounds really, really great. And also, when you do that relaunch, we would be happy to also publicize that in our network to our folks. And it sounds like it would be really worthwhile for us to have a link in various places on our website so that folks can access that easily when they're looking at our media-oriented tools. So I think this could be some really good cooperation.
Fantastic. Well, have a great weekend.
All right. Same to you. And thanks again.
Bye-bye.
Bye. All right. Wasn't that wonderful? I think you'd all agree that was very inspiring, and I look forward to putting some of that into practice and to working with you to help put it into practice in your towns with your local newspapers. We're going to be looking at together at the September action sheet in about 15 minutes. So folks that haven't already downloaded it or have access to it, please make it easily available. If you're online right now, you can go to the Action Resources page on our website, and there's a red monthly action ribbon on the right side. You can go there to download the September action sheet. And I also want to encourage you, if you have a newspaper nearby, either a hard copy or, again, if you're online and can look at a newspaper online, I think it would be useful to be able to access that newspaper in about 15 or 20 minutes. For folks who are new to this monthly call, we just had our guest speaker who spoke with us and had a wonderful discussion. And for the rest of the call, we've got some announcements about national happenings and also some announcements from the field. We'll be looking at the monthly action and having some coaching on taking the monthly action. So all are welcome to join us for the rest of this call. In terms of announcements, I first want to let folks know who are not available. Some of you know because you were with me. I just returned on Friday from a 14-day trip. I was all over the country. I made a big zigzag. I visited with 5 established teams and helped them to grow bigger and stronger, and that would include San Diego and the Inland Empire of California and Aurora and Crete, Illinois, and Clark County, Ohio. And we also started 5 brand new action teams. Those are in Champaign County, Ohio, Chicago and Posen, Illinois, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and Houston, Texas. And we also have a budding new team in Kalamazoo, Michigan. So I think if you were unmuted, you'd probably all be cheering for each other and for everyone here. I want to give a very warm welcome to any brand new people on this call who might be calling in for the first time on those new teams. Thanks for joining us, and we're so glad to have you all as part of this growing family of powerful agents for social change. Nearly all those new teams have now begun or are about to begin their team training modules, and we're very excited to watch them develop and to grow along with them. I have another special announcement from Molly Rowan Leach. Many of you know that Molly is our Restorative Justice Fellow with the Peace Alliance, and this fall, the new season of her call-in talk show, Restorative Justice on the Rise, has just begun. So I have this announcement, which she has sent to me, and I will read it aloud for you. Restorative Justice on the Rise is a public dialogue forum that engages with speakers from across the spectrum of systemic transformation, specifically pointing to ways in which solutions-based systems are being implemented, such as restorative justice, and also in other realms of peace building. Past speakers have included Michelle Alexander, Brian Stevenson, Dr. Johan Galtung, Dominic Barter, Fania Davis, and many, many more. Our next speaker is Dr. David Ragland, founder of the Truth Telling Project, and that's next Thursday, September 17th at 5 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Please visit restorativejusticeontherise.org for a national resource map and for archives of over 130 dialogues, a bookstore offering top-notch restorative justice books, and a chance to tap in with other practitioners and citizens who are working in their communities nationwide and beyond. The programs and resources have been underwritten and co-sponsored by private foundations and by the Peace Alliance, keeping it free for community use and participation. So from restorativejusticeontherise.org, you can register for the next call and see what's coming up. Next, I want to share stats and reporting. Statistics of your achievements, the following numbers represent your actions, their steps toward raising public awareness, strengthening cooperation, and creating political will for a sea change in the availability of peace-building tools. Every published letter to the editor represents thousands or tens of thousands of people who read and learned about practical solutions to reduce violence, transform conflict, and enhance cooperation. And every meeting with a congressional staff represents a policymaker who is better informed about positive, practical methods to build peace. So far in this past month, we've had one letter to the editor published, no op-eds, no editorials, one radio interview with two of our team leaders, five sit-down meetings with members of Congress or their staff, two tabling events, two coalition-building meetings, and one public presentation. And this year to date, we've had eight letters to the editor published, five op-ed pieces published, one editorial published, two radio interviews, 12 sit-down meetings with members of Congress or their staff, eight tabling events, 20 coalition-building meetings, and six presentations. So when I hear these numbers, I see just powerful building blocks. I picture each of those letters, each of those op-eds as reaching thousands or tens of thousands of people, each of those meetings as really developing the awareness and the strength of policymakers to make a positive change. These are gathered from our reporting tools on the website, and if you did meet with a Congress member or their staff or got some earned media or made some significant community contacts that we're not aware of, please let me or Lori know about it. I've been reaching out to team leaders to verify that we're accurately reporting on what you've been doing, and we've got reporting tools online under the Tools and Education tab where you can help us to make sure that we're reporting all your great work. Final announcement is a reminder regarding our conference. Our conference is coming up in Washington, D.C. on October 16th through 20th, and we're looking forward to seeing many of you here during that time. And we welcome all of you who are sort of on the fence to really give it a thought about coming and joining us in Washington, D.C. So kind of in place of or doubling as grassroots victories for this month, we've enlisted a couple of people to share about their experience regarding the conference. First, we want to hear from Elizabeth Scharbaum, who has not been to a conference yet, but has processed the idea and decided to step up and register and is planning on coming. So I want to hear about that process and what it looks like for your immediate future. Elizabeth, welcome. Will you go ahead and tell us what's on your mind?
Oh, geez. I have a lot on my mind, but I'll share quickly why I decided to come. I'm going to bring a visitor with me, my niece from Germany, and we're coming because it's an amazing lineup of speakers, and even if I don't think I'm really can be an activist, or I'm not sure I want to be one, the Peace Alliance is really important to me because it gives me method to my madness in a way by providing these tools that make me believe that we can do something about, you know, a lot of violence, sadness, terror, and so forth in the world. And in particular, it's my belief that security doesn't come from defense, but rather an absence of anxiety. And in that sense, the Youth Promise Act appealed to me as a way to teach to our youth that they don't need to fight to have their needs met. And restorative justice also is important to me as a way to reintegrate those who, where problems have occurred. So we very much look forward to being there and seeing all of you and sort of how government works and learning more about all of this.
That's wonderful, Elizabeth. Thank you so much. And I can appreciate that tension that I think I hear between not wanting to necessarily be an activist, whatever that might look like, but at the same time engaging very deeply with these questions and with the solutions and taking action, taking steps to make a difference. So if we can empower that strength in you, if we can help you to take those steps, I don't care what you call yourself. You can call yourself anything that you want. Keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you.
Thanks for sharing. And now we have one other person that's going to be sharing with us who actually has been to our conference last year or our lobby days last year and I think is looking forward to coming back to D.C. So Shannon, I would love to hear what you have to say to us.
Hi, Dan. It's wonderful to participate in today's call. Thank you for asking me. I am really looking forward to the conference. To give you a little bit of my history, the paradox for me is that the Peace Alliance and the like-minded individuals that will be participating in the conference have actually given me the tools that I've needed to follow, what our the sort of brand for the conference is, the movement is Be the Movement, in order to help others become more peaceful and bridge more peaceful alliances in the community and, our globe, we really have to be able to find that within ourselves and not just when things are going well, to be able to reach a place of love and communication when you are in pain or when a community is in pain is what I have been given through the Peace Alliance. Two examples of that are, Heart Phoenix with the River Phoenix Peace Center. I was able to take a Women's Only Boundaries course. I have been able to apply that course in my daily life every day since. It's been one of the biggest blessings I could ask for. It was where I was really having a weakness. She will be there. She will be one of the people that we will have the opportunity to listen to and to learn from. Sam Daly Harris, the Peace Alliance, had the book discussion, as part of the results. His book discussion, participating in that was just, it's where you caught me. It's where I fell in love because you listen to Sam and he puts it in you that, we're all doing a lot of complaining, but are you really participating in a solution here? And that's when I ended up making the commitment. So to go to this conference for me, and then the lobby days last year, Sam Daly Harris's book discussion had ended, and then the lobby days was coming up. It ended up being a situation I was able to go and participate. I met, obviously the staff of the Peace Alliance, but to meet Cheryl Kaplan, who is, out there and dealing with Teddy Ojo, and she's doing all of these things. She was, an article was published in her newspaper around the same time that Lobby Days happened. And to sit next to somebody and understand they have the same fears and intimidation as, you know, some of us are experiencing. When you're doing something outside of your comfort level and you get to talk and relate to people doing the same things that are negotiating their way around it through a support network, which is really what we are for each other, you make that human connection and you can't replace it. The conference to me is going to be more of those human connections. And, you know, it is about the movement of peace, but it's also about our journey and being able to enjoy it. This is going to be something, I mean, I'm so inspired and so in love with what's happened to my own life because of the Peace Alliance and because of the tools I'm able to really connect with when I'm in serious pain. I've taken the Peace Ambassador training through the SHIFT Network. You've led me to all of these amazing things, you know, that I actually utilize. I'm so excited about it that one of the young ladies I mentor, I'm bringing her along for the ride. She's a college student. She's doing amazing in college. It's a life-changing event, you know, for her to be able to talk to people who are, you know, applying these situations or these tools. You know, there's so many tools. Especially in the Rochester community right now, we need people who can be the peace. You know, unfortunately, last month we had 7 people shot right outside the Boys and Girls Club after a peaceful basketball game. And, you know, because of the people that I had met at Lobby Days, Gia being one of them, you meet people from all over the United States, and then we talk to each other, you know, throughout the year on these calls, you know, because of, I guess, the encouragement, the love, and the support, and knowing I'm not alone in this, I was able to reach out to 2 of the community solutionaries that are authors, Corey Lamar Tanksley. He's an author of B-Boy to Man, and the urban development author, Mr. Tracy Williams, and I was able to participate in their Father and Son Initiative meeting, as well as their Game Changers event. I will continue to do that, but it's because I met the people who are like-minded, you know, at Lobby Days. If I hadn't had that human connection, I think that it wouldn't be as embedded in me to want to continue to participate on a regular basis and learn more. I still have a lot of work to do, and I have a lot of learning to do, but my life means something more than the little world that I was stuck in before because of the Peace Alliance. So this conference means the world to me. I'm very excited and just so grateful for the opportunity. Thank you so much.
Wow, Shannon. Speaking of ambassadors, you're an amazing ambassador for this conference. I'd like to highlight so much of what you just said. Thank you for sharing with us. And I hope that other folks are equally inspired and thinking about the kind of connections that you can make here, really making it real and increasing your power and your possibility to make a strong difference in your own lives and in the lives of other people on this planet. There's still plenty of time to register, although the time is shrinking. On our homepage, you can go to the conference page and register right there. You can look at the list of speakers. You can look at the current schedule. And we would, as I said, certainly welcome you. If cost is an issue as far as registration, talk to somebody else on staff, and I'm sure we can work something out because we want you there. So moving right along, I'd like to review the action sheet. So if anybody has the action sheet right in front of you and might be willing to read aloud a little bit, I'd love to hear another voice on the call. So press 1 on your keypad if you've got the action sheet right in front of you and you're willing to read a little part of it. This is a little more complicated action than most, because this action actually gives you an option. It's 3 pages rather than the usual 2, because the first page is sort of guidance and instructions, and then the second page is on a particular topic, which is the Iran nuclear deal, and the third page is on another particular topic, which is the Youth Promise Act. So we're asking you to choose in your letter which one of those you'd like to write about. So I see Phineas again as thank you for volunteering. Phineas, welcome again. Would you be willing to read from the top of that of this action sheet, that first couple of bullet points, and then that first paragraph?
You want me to begin with the problems?
At the very top, it says letters to the editor.
Okay, remember, your letters are your own. It can be as basic or as detailed as you wish.
Can you speak a little louder, Finn? The volume is a little bit low.
Hear me now?
That's better, yeah, thanks. Are you on the page that says September 2015 action at the top?
Well, this page, yes, September 2015 action. I'm not on that page. I was on page 3.
Okay.
So you want me to begin at page 1?
Yes, please.
Letters to the editor honoring the UN-recognized International Day of Peace. Is that it?
Yes, please. Perfect. Please continue there.
Focusing on one of two topics. Bullet point one, the global importance of the Iran nuclear agreement, which Congress votes on this month, or bullet two, the local importance of passing the Youth Promise Act, bringing more peace to our communities. You will certainly be able to find an article you can respond to regarding either the Iran deal or local violence incarceration community. Through highlighting solutions and concrete policy goals, we can offer practical hope, solidarity, and empowering information to thousands of readers.
That's great. Thank you. That's perfect. You can stop there for us. Wonderful. This is pretty straightforward, I think. And what we're asking you to do is to respond to something that is in the paper that is either something about the Iran nuclear deal or about international tensions, or else something that's about local violence, about local issues, about local problems and solutions. And it's very, very likely that there will be an article on one of those things that you'll be able to respond to. And I wonder if anybody has a newspaper in front of you right now and would be willing to do a little exercise to demonstrate what it might look like to see an article and then begin to respond to it. Anybody have a newspaper in front of them and willing to do a quick exercise? And I want to acknowledge that we're 1 minute past the top of the hour, but I think we can go just two more minutes to make sure we get a little more familiarity with what this looks like. Anybody have a newspaper in front of them and feeling quite brave? If not, I can go ahead and show you what I mean. So in today's Washington Post, I'm just looking on online for the Washington Post, I see two articles that sort of jump out at me right away that would be easy for me to connect to these themes with. One of them is, it says, 3 people killed in overnight shootings in Baltimore. Okay, just from the headline, 3 people killed in overnight shootings in Baltimore, I begin to have a sense of how I would respond if I was writing my letter to the editor. And you can review that first page of the action sheet, which talks about responding with your feelings. So the first thing I would say is, I was saddened to read your recent article, 3 people killed in overnight shootings in Baltimore. This tragic waste of life and harm to our communities is something that does not have to continue with this level of force. There is a policy right now, there is a bill right now in Congress called the Youth Promise Act that would help to make our cities safer and to instill early intervention and prevention practices to help our young people have a better chance at growing up safe and healthy. So that's just off the top of my head, looking at a headline that deals with the Youth Promise Act. There There was another article about Dick Durbin, the senator from Illinois, and how he's been working during the summer to gather votes in support of the Iran nuclear agreement. And I could respond to that one by talking about I am so grateful for the work of Senator Durbin and others like him who have worked to make this diplomatic effort a success. I think so. Something along those lines would be the beginning of your letter. So I really want to encourage you to plan to take this action sometime in the next few days, if not today, and if not even in the next couple of hours. These actions are really the building blocks of the kind of change that we're looking to create. As you've heard from talking with David and from my descriptions of other people's activities, when we get these letters published, when we get these editors interested and informed, and then begin to share that with the public and with our members of Congress, this is a big part of how we change society. So if you have some kind of a buddy system in place, check in with each other, share your letters, read them to each other, and let each other know when the letter is sent. And if you're on an action team, then you have a built-in buddy system, and we hope that you will be in contact with your team and your team leaders to follow through on this and have a good time with it. So just in closing, I want to really thank you for being here and remind you that we are an organization working to support you at a level equal to your desire for change. And we really look forward to seeing your letters in print and seeing your communities blossom and learn these positive possibilities. And in a moment, I'm going to open up all the phone lines so you can say out loud thanks and have a good day or whatever you want to say to each other. Just one closing quote I want to add, which is from Eleanor Roosevelt, and this has been a go-to quote for me over the years. Eleanor Roosevelt said, "The future belongs to those who believe in the beauty of their dreams." The future belongs to those who believe in the beauty of their dreams. So please keep on dreaming with us and taking actions to make those dreams come true. And now I'm going to unmute all the mics. You're all unmuted. Feel free to say whatever you want and have a beautiful weekend.
Thanks, Anne.
Bye. Si se puede. Si se puede.
Thank you all. Keep going. Keep it going forward.
Much love, light, and peace.
Goodbye.